So kind of approaches like that feel really compelling to me because it's not improvisation, composition, you know, as two different things. They're the synthesis is much more organic, and that's super compelling to me and something that I'm always, I think, you know, endeavoring to push more and more into.
Welcome to episode 94 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. What's happening, folks? I feel like there's some updates I can give. My personal album is headed towards the finish line. I'm stoked about that. I'm so stoked about that. I did a photo shoot yesterday for it, and my friend Gary Fukushima, who is a brilliant piano player and also writes for the LA Times and Downbeat magazine, will be writing the liner notes for the album. The album is titled Smile. The album is 7 tunes. 5 of them I wrote. One tune on there is by my dear friend, the late Zane Musa, and the title track was composed by Charlie Chaplin with lyrics by John Turner and Jeffrey Parsons. I will have links and a couple tracks up very shortly for pre-order of the album. I don't really want to talk about a timeline too much until it's up, until it's officially up and everything's there, you know. You guys know how these things work. I need a little bump in the road. Can cause a delay. So I will talk about it when it's actually up instead of a projected date, because the projected date was actually October 15th. And here we are later than October 15th. So I will talk more about when it's actually up, but it's happening. It's happening. The recording is preparing for landing, and I'm excited about that. Other updates. What else? The Bass Shed Academy is forging ahead. We'll be having a launch party at Lemur Music on January 7th, 2023. The folks at Lemur and I will be raising awareness of the Bass Shed Academy throughout the local community down there in San Clemente, California. There's going to be some live performances by the faculty members. The faculty members are Marlon Martinez, fantastic double bassist, and he'll be teaching jazz and classical. Along with Chris Hornung, who is a fantastic classical double bassist and also teaches jazz history and rock history at a couple colleges. Last time I was down at Lemur, I think that we spent a bunch of time just kind of hanging out talking about rock history. That was a lot of fun. Then I'll be rounding it out teaching electric bass and double bass as well. So definitely stop by lemurmusic.com for anything and everything you need for the double bass. There'll be information there about the Bass Shed Academy as well as the bassshed.com. More stuff to put together, and I will keep you all updated as it all continues to evolve. All right, moving on. On the episode is composer and double bassist Joshua Stamper. Joshua Stamper has been a composer and collaborator for nearly 30 years, equally at home in jazz, classical, avant-garde, indie, alternative. He's worked with filmmakers, dancers, visual artists, poets, and architects. His work reflects a deep commitment to transdisciplinary collaboration. Joshua has also worked as an orchestral arranger, a studio conductor, a session musician for Columbia and Sony, and Concord Records, Lionsgate Films, Warner Brothers Pictures, and Legendary Entertainment. He's also worked for a handful of independent labels, including Domino, Dead Oceans, and Mason Jar Music. Joshua's work has been commissioned by several groups, including the Grammy-winning chamber choir, The Crossing. He is a McDowell Composition Fellow and is also the recipient of the Lincoln City Fellowship and the New Jersey State Council on the Arts Fellowship. His work has been supported by the American Composers Forum, the Lilly Endowment, the Ann M. and Philip H. Glatfettler III Family Foundation, and the Musical Fund Society of Philadelphia, the Eric Stokes Foundation, and the National Endowment of the Arts. Joshua's PR team had reached out to me to see if I might be interested in having him on the podcast to chat about his latest album titled Soma Schema. This is Stamper's 12th release as a leader. Soma Schema is an opus of compositions and audio collages inspired by Oliver Messiaen's time-stretching processes, chopped and screwed remix techniques, and the harmonic worlds of Bill Evans and Wayne Shorter. So, right, he's coming from a lot of places with it. I mean, those ones specifically, that's not a lot. That wasn't a lot, but it's a lot. Like, if you check out the record, it's a lot. So after they sent me a copy of the record, of course, I checked it out. It's absolutely brilliant. Joshua weaves together, like, all these different genres in a way that's really amazing. Each stylistic influence has space to exist independently while contributing to the entirety of the piece in a very deliberate and necessary way. Like, how he kind of weaves just all these styles and vocabularies and sounds together. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Joshua's album dropped on October 10th, and I will have links to his album and website at thebayshed.com/podcast/Joshua Stamper. All right, this Joshua was an amazing guest to have on the show, and really started to make me think about composition in a new way. And he talks about not only his process, but just how he conceives of sound and in different terms. And it's really, really fascinating. And so here it is. I'm going to let you hear it all from Josh himself. Here's my chat with double bassist and composer Joshua Stamper. Joshua.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Great.
Thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Cool. What part of the country are you in?
I'm just outside Philadelphia, and just across the river in New Jersey.
So, okay.
Yeah, okay. But for all intents and purposes, I'm in Philly. So,
how long have you been out there?
About, I think, coming up on 16 years.
16. Where were you at before that?
Up in Connecticut.
Okay.
Yeah, I went to school in Western Mass, and shortly after that, ended up teaching at a private prep school in Connecticut, and was there for about 9 years, and then moved this way. So,
what were you going to school for?
It was a double major of in music composition and playwriting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
I haven't written a play since college, but I have written a lot of music. I would love to get back to that at some point, you know. So,
but how much of the playwriting do you think informs the composition as far as story?
Yeah, that's a good question. I certainly think in terms of arcs and in terms of sort of larger structure, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And words have always been really important to me. So, you know, whether that's lyric or essay or whatever, that's certainly something that I really value. So, yeah.
When composing and when thinking of the entire arc, how much of the arc or the story of the composition do you let the music dictate, or how much do you have in mind when you begin? If you could guess,
no one
knows exactly. You can't qualify it, but do you have a strong sense of vision of how this thing is going to go, or do you just like, there's an initial thought or phrase or musical idea, and then you let the music finish the story?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And I feel like it's different for every piece.
Mm-hmm.
I think I do really appreciate in Stravinsky's Poetics on Music, a series of lectures that was done, I think, at Yale way back in the 1920s. It's either Yale or Harvard. But he sort of talks about how whenever he starts to, when he sets out to write a new piece, he draws the parameters around that as sort of tightly and as specifically as he possibly can, so that he basically has something to work against or work within. And he says that if he doesn't, do that, he's just kind of paralyzed by this infinitude of possibility, which I appreciate for sure. But at the same time, I think there is something to be said for letting form emerge. I think oftentimes when I'm writing, it is you're holding those two things in tension. Mm-hmm. You know, I might start with some vague sense of where this might be going, but holding that with an open hand, I think, is important. I do experience music in spatial terms. My brother is a filmmaker, but he was trained as a painter, and he had a painting professor who had said that painting is time, music is space, which is kind of odd. You would think it would be the opposite, you know? But that certainly rings true for me, that all of my favorite music is, it feels very much like an environment, a space that mm-hmm. there's, you know, there's room to explore, there's room to walk around and run around, play. And then on the flip side, there's also music that, you know, where you experience a certain kind of claustrophobia, you know, where the walls are just a little too close.
Yeah, that's true. And,
So anyway, all that to say, I think all of my favorite music, and certainly what I'm trying to do when I'm writing is create space, you know, with actual dimensions. You know, there's up, down, front, back, left, right. So
that's fascinating, because when listening to the record, it is very atmospheric. It's interesting. It's a fantastic record.
Thank you.
And because it's atmospheric, and then it's this room that you're invited into, and then it's also starting a very intelligent conversation within the room at the same time. So like, it brings you in, and then you're not just in the room, it's going to engage you once you're in there also. Mm-hmm. And it was more than just like this kind of cinematic thing that has a lot of imagery. Like it was really engaging. So to hear you speak about thinking about music in dimensional proximities and things like that is fascinating, because that was communicated for sure on the record.
So glad to hear that.
Yeah. That's a fascinating idea. I've never heard music talked about in that sense. How do you know when you achieve it, or when you're just composing? Maybe this is a conversation to have about process, but when you're composing, how can you know that that thing is being achieved until you hear it played back? Or once it's in the studio and you start doing layering, then it seems like you'll know if you're achieving it. But if you're just composing pen to paper, how do you know if the piece is working?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I think, again, sort of thinking about the spatial aspect of music, I think for me, it has a lot to do with, does this space feel like, do I have room to move around? Do I have, mm-hmm. is it something that I could spend time? Is it a space I could spend time exploring? And if I start to feel like there's a where those walls are getting a little bit too close, then there might be things that I adjust either to expand the walls or to basically suggest that the time that you spend in this particular space is just for a limited time. You know, it ushers you into a breezeway into some other space. It's just this little kind of micro place that you inhabit for a little bit, and then you move on. So sort of scaling, maybe scaling time to the sort of largeness of the space that feels like, mm-hmm. that's being, you know, that you might want to spend there. But I also really love these little kind of spaces that, you know, these kind of micro, like there's a couple pieces on the record that are really, really short. And for me, those still feel expansive, but it's more like just kind of peeking in the window to see what's in there. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's it's hard. Sometimes it's hard to talk about these things.
They're
so abstract.
Yeah, because it's so much of an emotional response to it, you know. And yeah, it's hard to qualify what that thing is, or who have been some composers or artists that have that you go to for inspiration to maybe check out how they're doing it, to learn some techniques or ideas about how to investigate this in your own artistry.
Yeah, so I started really, really getting interested in composing when I was in high school. We had the really, really good fortune of having a music teacher who he really took students seriously and what they were capable of and what they could appreciate and what they might respond to. And so he was always giving us the real literature. We weren't getting like dumbed down Bob Dylan medleys or you know, Phantom of the Opera scores or something like that. We were dealing with, I was in the chamber singers for a while, and we were singing things like Palestrina and Beethoven's Mass in C and Mendelssohn motets, and we even ended up singing some Schoenberg, you know, and the Brahms Requiem, and I mean all this really heavy literature.
Yeah.
And so, and being in the midst of that and feeling all of these lines intertwining, it was like, I don't know what this is, but I really need to figure it out. And that sort of alongside, you know, just this growing love for jazz and for R&B and for Prince and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Whereas experiencing those kind of same kinds of spaces really opening up. And so in terms of really influential composers and musicians, and this is related to the earlier discussion about space, I feel so much affinity for early 20th century classical music, Stravinsky, Bartok.
Before it got really atonal, like those things still had kind of a tonality.
Yeah, yeah, it was certainly pushing at the boundaries of it for sure. But yeah, really, there was just sort of a visceral quality to it that I was really smitten by, and I do appreciate, you know, the atonal stuff for sure. I've recently really, really gotten into a Polish composer named Witold Lutosławski. Just unbelievable composer and orchestrator. In any case, so those guys, Ravel, WC, of course. And then alongside that, people like, I mean, the second Miles Quintet, just mm-hmm. I could listen to that band forever.
Right. The 60s.
Yeah. So yeah, but I think I'm a pretty kind of omnivorous listener. yeah.
On that topic, what are you listening to right now? Like, what's a record or an artist you've been checking out lately?
Yeah. So, well, like I said, Lutosławski. But also, I just picked up this record that I've been looking for years, and it happened upon it. It's a record that's just called Jobim, but it's Jobim with all of these orchestrations by Klaus Ogerman, I think is how you say it. This just fantastic and really kind of surprising pieces. I think he might have written some of them for film. I don't know which films, but it does kind of have some of that quality of that kind of early Stravinsky stuff at points, and that paired with the sort of humility and immediacy of Jobim's voice is really, really striking. So So there's that. And then just picked up a new Kenny Wheeler record that is amazing. It's Kenny Wheeler and Keith Jarrett, Jack DeJohnette, and Dave Holland. New High is the record.
New High. I don't think I have that one.
Oh, man. Kenny Wheeler is one of my favorites. And yeah, in terms of other favorite trumpet players, I think Wadada Leo Smith is just outrageous. There's so much information contained within one note. It's really, really beautiful.
So at what point have you had formal jazz studies?
Ish. Maybe not, actually. I mean, I had always loved jazz, but when I graduated from college, shortly after, I was hired to teach jazz at this private prep school, and so that gave me an excuse to really dive in, and it was a lot of self-study and just transcribing Charlie Parker solos and writing arrangements for students it was a great there's nothing like having to teach something to to make you learn it.
That's the truth.
So that and then out of that I started forming my own ensembles, really just as kind of composition laboratories. And
is there a live performance outlet for these groups, or do they stay as recording projects?
For this particular ensemble, Color is Time, it has been a challenge. Yes, there is a performing aspect to it, but it's a challenging thing because everybody is so good, they're really in demand. So getting everybody in the same room is a task, and all the more so because now the ensemble spans three states and two continents. And so, but we do have a release show scheduled in December.
Where
everybody's going to be this brief two-day window. We're going to be able to, do a rehearsal and then perform it. So,
is that going to be really in the Philadelphia area? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Is that where you originally connected with all the musicians? Was through Philly? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, for sure. And
they're touring now, or they just live somewhere else?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes it rough.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my my drummers, I don't know, he's somewhere in the, he lives in Philly, but he's somewhere, I don't know, somewhere in the country. And then my woodwind player is in Korea right now. And one of my piano players is in Prague. And yeah, it's just, so they're all over the place. But we met, doing different projects and different configurations in Philly for years. And it's a really special ensemble. I think, I think different types of music really have different kind of rhythmic vernaculars. And so it takes time to really understand, to become bi or trilingual, in different genres, in terms of the way that rhythm is understood, and there are some early attempts to synthesize classical and jazz that really kind of now feel they either fall really flat or they sound hokey, and I think a lot of that has to do with that issue of rhythmic vernacular. But I think that's also true of individuals, that every single person has their own kind of way of conceiving of rhythm and time and harmony, and there are these sort of very specific and particular particularities or sensibilities rather, and so when you have a group of musicians that have been playing together for a long, long time, that there's a shared language that ends up being developed, that's certainly how this ensemble feels to me.
Yeah. I was going to ask about that, because getting into a project that is coming from so many different places, and as a composer, do you think about how much vocabulary to use from each kind of style? I doubt it's that black and white or cut and dry when you're thinking about it. Mm-hmm. But it's coming from all these different places. And what you were talking about is the rhythmic vocabulary. Mm-hmm. How do you approach that as a composer? Because to really sell the idea of something, you got to do that rhythmic vocabulary thing or that harmonic vocabulary thing. But when it's coming from so many different places, how do you acknowledge a genre or style and not fully commit to a vocabulary?
Yeah, I don't think about that at all.
Okay.
I think it's just being so steeped in all of this different music, and it sort of
just comes out,
filters through, yeah. through yeah, yeah. a single person, and then you know, and so that sort of vernacular is referenced, but it's not any kind of explicit referencing. It's been internalized, and the execution of the music, I think, really requires an understanding of these different kind of rhythmic and harmonic sensibilities. But it's also a lot of it is kind of high risk music, in terms of, you know, where you have composite rhythms or like, it's very, you know, they're some of it's very, very, very tightly composed, and there are grooves to be had, but they're hard won, you know, and so I think, you know, committing to that work together is has been also a big part of things.
Mm-hmm. So you play double bass on the album, and you also play guitar. What was the first instrument for you as a person? Was it piano or something that you were composing on first before those two?
Do you mean for this project specifically, or
no,
just
for just you in your career and your musical journey?
Yeah. So my first instrument was actually double bass, but
really?
I didn't know how to play it at all. I mean, I got it in you know, with the fifth grade kind sure. of elementary string program, and you know, I think I had learned how to play the theme from Darth Vader, and every time we would have to play a school concert, I didn't have any idea what I was doing. I was just look busy.
Yeah. Look busy. I like that. Yeah. Right? The thing I'm playing, if I just look busy and frustrated.
Yeah. Exactly. And then, so I stopped that. And then in eighth grade, ended up starting guitar lessons. And that really is where I think a lot of my musical interest was really kind of catalyzed. And then, and then I actually didn't come back to double bass until I was teaching at that private high school. We had gotten a donation, and with the chair of the music department, used the donation to buy a double bass.
Mm-hmm.
And I was teaching these jazz groups, and none of the students were interested in playing, but I was like, well, it's here, you know,
no.
as well, you know, try to start learning how to play this thing. And then I started getting hired to play sessions, and I was like, oh man, now I need to really learn how to play this thing. So yeah, I mean, it's the learning is certainly never ending. And,
sure.
It's when I think about the bass players that I really love, I'm not a bass player, if that makes any sense.
Sure, you know, sure.
I do perform on it, and I'm hired to do sessions for sure. But when I think about, you know, some of my heroes, you know, it's that's another thing entirely.
Yeah, I mean, the heroes keep everybody. You know, like, you're never ever gonna get it, you know, like who are your specific heroes, or some of them at least?
Yeah, sure. Well, I love, of course, Charlie Hayden, and just his sound is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Larry Grenadier, I really love. Scott Colley.
Yeah.
Ron Carter, Anders Dorman, just beautiful. I love Red Mitchell's sound. Just a huge sound. But there's this kind of detail to it that's really so beautiful. Gary Peacock. Yeah. So those are some of them.
What are you? Are you working on another project now? Like, this record just came out. When was the actual release date?
Last Monday.
Last Monday. Congratulations. Yeah. That was
Hot off the presses.
Yeah. Yeah, your PR team had, I forgot when they emailed me. It was maybe a month and a half ago or something.
Cool.
And it took me a while. It took me a while to know I could listen to the album before I committed to it or not. Because sometimes I get these emails like, hey, would you be interested in doing this? And then I'll check out the record. Like, there's nothing intriguing about this. I don't know if I have anything to talk about.
Right, right.
So I don't do it. I always have to listen to the record first. So how does it feel to have it out into the world? Does it just feel like the weight is lifted off? Or does it feel like, well, now step two, I got to kind of, you know, get word out on this? And
yeah, I mean, there's always that, that sort of promotion time that is certainly interviews like this are helpful, you know, because they are actual conversations, but which feels a little bit more meaningful. But it's this whole kind of period is my least favorite part of the process.
right.
Because I don't know. I think there's always a threat to a special project, the sort of joy being, you know, seeping out of it, because the whole promotion machine is, I think that, you know, it's often is the introduction of a whole bunch of foreign metrics about where the value in your music is actually situated. And
yeah, because it turns the artistic endeavor into commerce, and that process,
it can mess with your head.
Yeah, okay. That's a way of saying it. Yeah, I was trying to think of something. Yeah, yeah. I can see that. Well, especially, how long did the album take you? And well, let's start with the material as well, from beginning to end. The pieces that are on here, there is, I have it pulled up right here. There's 15 tracks on the album. Mm-hmm. How long have some of these been in the process of being written? Like, have you had some sitting around for years and then finally they found a place, or were these written for the album?
Yeah, so this these pieces, I think, were written over the course of a year, year and change, and it sort of workshopped in rehearsal and then performance, and then and so we did the initial recording session in 2019, actually, in the summer of 2019, and the initial recording session was a disaster. It was just every technical difficulty that could have happened. And so we didn't actually press record until about 5 hours after we were supposed to.
Wow.
And so it's sort of like
where was everybody's mood like then? Because you've got a bunch of studio guys and it's 5 hours later. It's like, dude, I'm hungry. I got a gig tonight. Like, mm-hmm. What are we doing here?
Yeah. Well, it was really kind of like, you have a bunch of elite athletes waiting for the, you know, poised and waiting for the gun to go off. And, but holding, you can only hold that pose for so long, ready to go before you just become exhausted. And so, by the time we actually, hit record, everybody was spent. So, you know, the session was, it was a very depressing session in that, I mean, it didn't represent the music well. It didn't represent the players well. And so I ended up listening through everything. And, the ideal was, well, we get everybody in the same room again and we just try to figure it out. But again, everybody is just so, so busy that was impossible. And so then the idea of overdubbing kind of started exploring that, and thankfully when I listened through everything, the drums were all solid and really, really good performances, and the double basses were solid, and some guitars and some keys, but everything else needed to be redone. So there was some things that were salvageable, and so we kind of retracked over that time. But then I actually ended up getting really excited because I decided to take all of that unusable material the basically the stuff that was trash from that session.
Yeah.
And took it and chopped it all up and created new compositions out of that. So all that materials, it might feature a horn from this song and a trombone from that song and drums from a different song. And some of that, you know, I pitch shifted or ran backwards or, you know, just kind of really played with it. And, yeah. And it was really, really fun. And, you know, I ended up taking, bringing in a nylon string guitar and kind of started adding nylon string guitar to these new collage compositions that I was making. And I really liked that contrast between the sort of humility and the immediacy of this, you know, of this nylon string texture paired with this stuff that's clearly super processed and chopped up. And I think that contrast was really compelling to me. So those ended up being these little kind of vignettes that are peppered through the album. And or you get these little kind of sort of micro excursions into a kind of a parallel sonic universe. So that was exciting, actually. So what it's just like, you know, I think so much of the time the task of the artist is to make lemonade out of lemons. So that's what we did. And yeah. So that stuff was composed specifically for the record.
Okay.
But everything else had been composed beforehand.
When picking some of the instrumentation on this record, I liked how you just spoke about it with humility and immediacy. Do you, when you're listening back, do you feel like, everything's cool, but this tune needs more immediacy, or this needs more humility, or this needs humor, or this needs, is that how you think of it before you associate an instrument to that sound? Do you think about the almost human characteristic of it first?
Well, I think if I do think about those things, it's more I'm thinking about the specific players.
Okay.
And their own kind of qualities as human beings.
Okay, so not the nature of the sound of an instrument. Because I think it was track 10, all of a sudden there's accordion, and that completely caught me off guard. I'm like, oh, yeah. Okay, we're doing that now. What's up, everybody? Okay.
Right.
Let's go.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. Strap yourself in. Yeah. You're gonna get wild. Right. Yeah. No, each person's personality, it filters through their instrument, and it does affect their sound for sure. Yeah. And I mean, I think one of the reasons, the things I love about this group is that, I mean, these are dear, dear friends, and there is this kind of shared love for, a shared sense of play. And there's kind of a wry humor that often kind of comes through in people's playing, and but not in a jokey way.
Right.
And as well as a real shared love of space. All that to say that, again, you know, in terms of those particular qualities that you were asking about and thinking about sound, I do think about sound as I'm writing, but again, it's sound attached to individuals.
So you're thinking about the performer before the instrument.
Yeah. Okay. I think so. Sort of in the same way. I mean, not that I'm comparing myself to Duke Ellington, but the way that he would write specifically for, you know, like when he would write a trombone part, he wasn't writing a trombone part. He was writing a part for Juan Tizol, you know, that kind of idea. Yeah. That there's very, very kind of particular ways that they approach, approach phrasing there's particularities to their sound, that you kind of have in mind as you're writing.
Yeah. How do some of those those elements that you would go back in and chop up and add to the record that were done after the fact, how do you communicate those live? Do you have tracks that are triggered? Do you have synth players that are duplicating the parts? Do you just leave it up as like something goes there, but it doesn't have to be that part specifically?
Yeah, no, those, I don't think that we will do those live.
Okay.
Because I think those are studio creations.
And, yeah.
And I mean, we get to similar kinds of spaces in kind of, you know, when we're playing live, we certainly stretch things and
sure.
access a similar kind of space as those interludes, just in an improvisational context. So
when composing, how much room do you leave for the improviser?
That's a good question. That's actually been a question that I've been wrestling with for probably 15 to 20 years.
Yeah.
And it has to do with this creating a synthesis between improvised music and composed music that feels really authentic and really genuine. And I think that, I mean, there's plenty of music that is great, that's like highly composed. And then there's the section where everybody takes solos and then mm-hmm. you come back to the highly composed stuff. And that always feels a little bit unsatisfying to me, at least in my own work. I really want there to be where the improvisation to grow out of something, or mm-hmm. there's where it feels like it's contributing to structure that's emerging. So I guess, sure, that's very vague and
no, I think that makes sense actually. Like, to speak to just that. I mean, I remember a recording project I did, it was a long time ago, 2012. But yeah, it's something I've always been wrestling with too, is where mm-hmm. where the composition and improvisation meet.
Yeah, as far or how as that relationship works.
Yeah. Yeah, as far as the material. So that you're not just showing up with a lead sheet.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that model gets tiring to listen to. Mm-hmm. Too much back in the, you know, back to back to back. Mm-hmm. So I've been wrestling with it. And, you know, I wrote one piece that we would just play. And the only objective was eventually make it to the melody. And it was over. And however we got there, we got there. But like...
Sure.
You know, the first chord is like, I forgot what it was. I think it was a B-flat minor 9 or something. Like, make it to the B-flat minor 9 and then let's start the melody. And then once that's the end. Like, this tune is about the process to get there.
Yeah. Sort of like that countdown structure where it starts with the solo and then, you know,
yeah.
and ends with the melody. Although what you're describing is more free than that. But I think I've been super, super intrigued with Anthony Braxton and have done a bunch of reading about how he answers those questions. And this is actually, it's a very question is one of the things that I'm really, I find so exciting about Ludoslavski's music, is that as a classical composer, he's really trying to deal with those same kinds of questions. And so there are these, in his later work, he was really, you know, he would have these sections where he would enable different groups within the orchestra. You know, he would write out melodies, you know, the pitches and the rhythms are fixed, but they could be played at different tempos at the same time, or they could be, you know, he was still kind of authoring the thing, but really, really giving the player latitude to interpret the way that they've felt it. But you know, he would do that to, you know, give that latitude to an entire string section, for example, or soloists within a wind section. So you mm-hmm. hear these melodies that I don't know, they end up kind of sounding like a flock of birds or something. It's really fascinating. And
right, right. Because so you're just getting these little, these pockets of activity. You know, like if you're taking a,
yeah.
if you're looking down from above the clouds on a storm, you can kind of see these little synapses exactly. firing off.
Yeah, no, that's a great illustration. It really does. Yeah, it's just beautiful, and it's much more about texture
mm-hmm.
and these sort of gossamer glistening texture that ends up being created, and so kind of approaches like that feel really compelling to me because it's not improvisation, composition, you know, as two different things. They're the synthesis is much more organic, and
sure.
That's super compelling to me, and something that I'm always, I think, you know, endeavoring to push more and more into.
Yeah.
And yeah. So.
Yeah. I was talking to a guitar player, I don't know, not that long ago. And, I forgot what we were talking about, but we ended up talking about that idea. And both of us decided on the fact that our writing sucks, because if we write something that we like to listen to, it's not fun to play over, you know, to right. solo over. Right. But then like things that are fun to solo over aren't interesting to. So we both realized that we suck, but it's an ongoing thing to find something that's engaging that I want to play over as a soloist,
sure.
but also like a piece of music that I would just want to listen to. It's this never-ending battle. On your recording, there's some other elements like that are kind of not counter elements that you're using to work together, but you're like sometimes a lot of quick transitions and almost drone-like repetitions. Those two you have kind of working in a close relationship on the record. How do you think about that? Because I think that idea is very similar to putting two different things together, just like composition and improvisation, dealing with elements of change, but also elements of static mm-hmm. in a repetition. So how do you go about working that relationship?
Yeah, well, I think about the landscape artist Andy Goldsworthy and just phenomenal work, and all of his work is sort of using he's a visual artist but you know, sculptor, but he uses time as a material, and he's a lot of his work is in, you know, working outside and, you know, using natural materials, and it's just extraordinary work. But he talks about the best. Well, really, the only way to observe change is to stay in one place. I think
that's I like that. I've never thought about that, but that's really brilliant, actually.
For sure, yeah. And I think you have to have that contrast of something that is a static element
for context.
Because otherwise, there's nothing. You don't have any. You don't. That's the thing that provides your bearings so that you can actually see what's changing, what's
right.
morphing. And so, I do think that contrast is a tool that, that's very present in the way that I think. The way that contrast is leveraged, and sometimes it's, you know, things get hazy and sometimes things are stark, but there's always, but that contrast has to be there in some way. Even just thinking about the basics of syncopation, syncopation requires just a rock solid sense of the internal beat. Otherwise, it's sort of like trying to dribble a basketball in a muddy field. It's going to be pretty unsatisfying. So I think having something hard to bounce off of, you know, whether you're talking rhythmically or harmonically or whatever, I think it's really, really critical.
Right. All right. That's fascinating because I've never thought about it in quite those terms. But I like all that. And then how, what is your approach like to form and investigating newness within form or forms that you're exploring?
Yeah, well, I think it gets back to that question of experiencing music spatially. And does this feel like a space that keeps revealing itself? And you know, so often that that's something that is, it's an ongoing question, you know, as I'm writing, you know, do I feel like there's more to explore even after a piece is done? And that to me, I think is when I've hit on something is after I've hit the last or written the last note, if it feels like there's more to explore, as I'm listening, that's usually a really, really good sign.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, in terms of form, I think part of that has to do with the, I feel like you're always in dialogue with the kind of tensile strength of an idea. And, you know, if you, that it's important to kind of, I mean, if you stretch it too far, of course it snaps or it loses all its elasticity.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that I am really, really aware of when I'm writing, in terms of structure, in terms of the form, you know, does that tension feel like it's still present, or does it feel like it's losing its elasticity?
Yeah. That's interesting. What you just said about once you've written the last note and there's still something left, that's exactly how I felt as soon as the album ended.
I'm so like, glad to hear that.
Like it wasn't, not that wasn't complete, mm-hmm. but it wasn't this strong sense of resolution. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay. Like I had to just kind of sit there for a second. I was processing so much of what I just heard. But it wasn't over. So mentally, I went back and replayed the things that I was hearing because I was like trying to keep the party going.
That's a high compliment. I'm glad.
So it's interesting that you're aware of that within your writing because that's exactly how I felt once the album ended, which I thought was great. Yeah. It left me in a very specific place. What is the relevance of the titles as it relates to the piece of music itself?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is just...
some guys just have words that are placeholders so that they know you know what how to reference a chart when they're telling guys to pull up a tune.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that for me, it has to connect with not so much in terms of what the words, sometimes in terms of what the words in the title themselves actually mean, but sometimes it's just that even the sound of the words feels consistent with the music and, you know, sort of like James Joyce and Finnegan's Wake or Ulysses, you know, that so much of what those really, really, really difficult books, I think ultimately are about is just the sound of language and the sound of words. And so yeah, there is this, you know, for me, that's kind of a playful place to, explore things and, or maybe an extension of that process of, and really, yeah, bringing in play, you know, yeah, so I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. It does. Yeah, and it reminded me of, I think something, it was an interview I read one time with Tom York from Radiohead.
Right.
She's just like, I'm not always interested in the meaning of words.
Yeah.
Sometimes it just has to do with sound.
Yeah, for sure.
Made Radiohead make way more sense. Like, okay. That's sure. fair. That's fair. Because I was trying to piece these definitions together and I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that was interesting to me. And there's some other singers I feel like that might utilize that idea, although I haven't heard them speak to it directly. But there's some early Fiona Apple that I could probably think of where she utilized that technique with going for words for sound.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
over function.
Right, right. Yeah.
Which is really interesting. And so you were speaking at the beginning, the words and speech have always been very important to you. Is this something you're interested in investigating to bring that more into the music? Have a narration or poem or verse?
Sure. Yeah. No, I've definitely written pieces that involve spoken word or utilized voice or sound the sound of voice in a really important way. I mean, I have, you know, a couple albums with songs. Uh-huh. But, you know, lyrics and stuff. But there was a piece I was commissioned to write in 2017 by this extraordinary chamber choir called The Crossing. And for that piece, the libretto was written. So the piece was basically, it was the second chapter of this four-part series that I've been working on called Elements. And it's sort of looking at the four classical elements, water, air, fire, and earth, and how those are manifest specifically in Philadelphia history and culture. And so for this second chapter, it was all about air or wind. And there's nothing really that singular about wind in Philadelphia. It's not like, it's not known for its wind. It's not like Chicago or something that. But so then the idea kind of came, what if I gathered texts that had been picked up, carried, and deposited by the wind in Philadelphia and sort of harvested all that text. And then that would become the word bank that I would then use to create the libretto. And that's what I did. I had these sort of six journeys into the city that I went around and just took tons and tons of pictures of basically trash, and then got home and transcribed all that. And then wrote the libretto from there. But in answer to your question, you know, the way that voice is used there and sound, the sound of the human voice, you know, there are parts where people are speaking or whispering or whistling or as well as singing, of course. And the human voice is a remarkable instrument. I think kind of underexplored in terms of what it can do, you know. Mm-hmm. All that to say, I really, really love kind of pressing into that kind of thing. But I am really, really fascinated with texts that are also in dialogue with one another. And yeah, so in any case, I know it's a little bit of a rabbit trail, but
no, but that's good. That means you're on to something that you're pursuing, and it's been a journey for you. So that's I think that's great. This, when you were going and doing these little excursions around Philadelphia and you're finding the words that were blown by the wind, I think that's a fascinating way to connect with the element. Mm-hmm. When put together and you pull from all these different pieces of trash, did you create a narrative out of it, or did you keep it pretty eclectic or eccentric?
That's a great question. So what I did was, so each movement is basically a different journey into a different part of Philadelphia. So each movement has its own word bank, you know, collection of texts that were harvested. But then in terms of words being in dialogue with each other, so I took, I used a poetic form that was pioneered by John Cage. It's called a mazostic. And basically the way it's the same thing as an acrostic, except that rather than the vertical word being on the left side of the page, left side of the poem, it's actually in the middle. So it sort of goes through like a spine. And there are kind of rules that dictate what words are allowed on either side of each middle letter that's going down. And so it's kind of a very simple, but a very strict form. And so, So that for those spine texts, I was using little tiny passages from the Bible about wind or air. And
why the Bible specifically?
Well, I think because it's a fixed text. Mm-hmm. And so this fixed text in relationship with texts that are literally disposable, sure, transitory, ephemeral. And so that sort of...
So that's your constant, just like we were talking about a second ago, like that's the constant for everything to pivot around.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so this kind of, this spine text ends up becoming this kind of invisible kind of DNA helix that the entire rest of the libretto is organized around. And there's no way that listening, you would be able to discern what that spine text is. You would have to actually look at it. Mm-hmm. But it has absolute governing authority, you know. And so yeah, that those kinds of relationships are really, really interesting to me. And the piece that I'm working on now is a piece for string quartet and percussion sextet, and this is the third chapter in that series. This one's about fire, and this is also another, I guess, part of my ongoing fascination with things that are emerging or in dialogue. And so this piece is the conceit with the score is basically it doesn't operate like a normal score. It's what I'm doing is writing a hyperlinked score. So each musician is reading their music off of tablets, and on each page of each person's music, there are these collections of hyperlinks so for example, the cellist is reading along, they get to measure 14, and they'll encounter a collection of four or five different links, each link connecting to a different part in the score. And so where whatever link they choose, it shoots them to that place.
To choose your own adventure book.
Yeah. It's a choose your own adventure musical methodology. Basically. And so all 10 musicians end up kind of creating these 10 independent paths through the master score. And it is, every time it's performed, it's a completely new, unique piece, you know, because they're all taking different routes each time. And
would this be? Let's say there's 10 musicians, they all get to measure 14. Now, are they all making decisions at the same measure, or is cello one making a decision at measure 14? But, you know, I'm not sure of the exact instrumentation, but, you know, bass clarinet made the decision already at measure 9.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so,
no,
it's always very disconnected in when they make the decisions.
Yeah, it's more the latter where because the linking choices are determined according to phrase lengths phrase endings, phrase beginnings.
Okay.
And so where the link actually becomes a possibility, it's often like at the end of a phrase, and it's linking to somewhere else in the score that's the beginning of a different phrase. And so yeah, that's sort of with this conceit, questions of, you know, form is emergent, and it's the whole kind of idea is about potential. You know, whatever route any musician takes, it was always a route there to be taken. But you know, in this, so I wrote one movement as a proof of concept in it, and you know, the audience would only ever experience that movement as being about 4 minutes long, but it basically has, you know, 8 score layers, or, you know, sort of that's what I've been calling them, stacks of score on top of each other, that, you know,
possible routes, like possible ways it could end.
Well, it's
journeys it could go on.
Yeah. The way that it's structured is, so within this, proof of concept, there are 767 links total, and I had 8 different layers of score, which are basically just discrete pieces stacked on top of each other. So back to that idea of the cellist, they get to measure 14 and they choose a link, they start on layer 3, and then they choose a link, it shoots them to layer 1, they encounter another link, it shoots them down to layer 7, etc. And so they're all kind of doing this, and it creates this kind of web, or maybe it looks like a New York City subway map. You know? Yeah, but basically each movement is hooked to a different narrative in Philadelphia history having to do with fire. And there's all these really remarkable stories in Philadelphia with fire as both a constructive force but a destructive fact. And so that, I think that's one of the things that, you know, again, speaking about relationships, that I'm really compelled by with this whole series is the ways in which each of these elements are connected, or either, well, at the same time, absolutely critical to human flourishing, but also represent some kind of severe liability to human thriving. And so,
sure.
So that juxtaposition is super, super interesting to me. So,
I mean, I think that can almost be said for, I mean, there's not enough time to literally think about everything before I say this, but if you take an idea such as fire or a human quality, like someone being impulsive, mm-hmm. It's almost like everything is on its own micro pendulum. And like to one point, absolutely, you know, you're excelling, but then there's going to be the equal opposite reaction, right? It always goes back to Newton's law. Mm-hmm. In which case, to ever whatever degree it was positive, to the same degree it could potentially be negative, and probably at some point will,
for sure.
I think everything, elements within the world, all elements, you know, work like that. Like we need rain to grow agriculture, but then you can have traumatic storms as well. Yeah. You know, so yeah. It's both absolutely necessary and then can clean out some things and be destructive.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and even the notion of a hyperlink, you know, our entire lives are sort of centered around the internet, you know, and there's an amazing possibility that is in front of us by virtue of the internet. Mm-hmm. But also, I mean, you don't have to, you know, you go to any front page of any news website and you just see the sort of catastrophic events with how the internet is leveraged to rip societies apart. So yeah, so it's just a fascinating thing, and really I think kind of presses on these questions of the ways in which not just what do we do with the tools that we have, but how are we shaped by the tools that we use. And those are really, I think, pretty pressing questions to be thinking through together. So,
yeah, and the relationship of are the tools shaping us or are we shaping with the tools? Mm-hmm. I think is always. I was just ranting about this the other night, in much much different context. Right. But you know, I forgot how we got on this part of the conversation, but. When my TV will ask me, like, are you still watching this? Because whatever, I left the TV on or whatever.
Sure.
And I was ranting about at what point did it happen where I now have to answer to my TV. Like, I think this is ludicrous that I have to respond to this and I have to engage with my television and be accountable to what it's asking me.
Right.
And so that led us down the rabbit hole of... At what point we're working for the tools and the tools were working for us,
right?
You know, and that relationship. And it's fascinating to me that within your artistry, you're digging into all these, they're not micro relationships, but they're nuanced relationships. Mm-hmm. And you're really taking the time to investigate all those. And I think that's really fascinating because when you just accept them and don't look into them, you can easily end up in a place where you missed a lot.
Right. Yeah. So it's, I'm either, onto something, or this is just me working out my neuroses.
that's all we're all doing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's all this is.
Right.
How did you kind of stumble across that hyperlink concept?
You know, I don't know. I had done this fellowship in 2019 at this really wonderful artist residency called McDowell. And actually where I first sort of started working on this piece about fire. And I mean, I was just doing just lots and lots and lots of research and lots of just sketching. And but even back then I was like, what, you know, I was just sort of thinking about the way that jazz often works, and that, you know, you have the head, and then everybody's, you know, blows over the changes, and just thinking about the fact that those changes represent, I mean, there's just a million possibilities in terms of how those could be interacted with, and which is why we have millions and millions of jazz recordings of the same song.
Sure.
And because, yeah, it's kind of endless, but thinking about like, what would there be ways to kind of leverage that kind of infinitude of possibilities in a compositional framework. And so that was kind of just in the back of my mind way back then. I don't know, maybe it was, I started using this note-taking app called Obsidian, which allows you, as you're taking notes, to create these little links to other notes that you've made. And, and I mean, it's a really, really great tool. And I think I was just bopping along, and that's probably where the idea came. I was like, wait a minute, what if I could sort of take this idea and somehow work with it musically?
It's a great way to, you kind of go back to a previous topic, to engage with composition and improvisation, because right. The choices that they're making, although predisposed, it's an improvised moment of
right.
artistic, yeah. you know, expression or decision.
Yeah. Yeah. You're ceding authorship to,
yeah.
to the musician.
Right? Yeah. Right. Well put.
Even though you're the one that made the choices available.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Right. What did that feel like? Did that just feel like some all-seeing eye God figure when you're composing this? Like, I know where you're going and you don't at measure 14, cello player.
Yeah, no, hardly. I think because, I mean, there's even with something with a finite number of links, like 767 links, it really is. I mean, it's just thousands and thousands and thousands of combinations that those links represent, and there's no way to run all those combinations, and this is just one movement of what will be a 10 movement piece.
Wow.
And so yeah, there's certainly no pretension to any sort of,
how do you know that they all work together? Like, is it always so, like, going back to the same example of cello player picks this route in measure 14, sure. Do all of those choices end up as a voice within the same chord? Or is that how you can understand that they work, because you can't necessarily check them all?
Yes. I mean, that's part of it. I mean, I think that part of what you're doing in this kind of way of writing is that you're trying to create, well, really, I mean, back to that idea of space, you're trying to create a musical environment in which, you know, it sort of maximizes the possibility of musical coherence. But again, still, you know, not dictating exactly what's going to happen, I think it's an interesting tension to me. And so, I mean, I think that part of, I think jazz was really, really helpful in my study of it in terms of realizing just how supple harmony actually is, that it's a very, very flexible thing, you know, you know, I think about the ways that, again, I'm back to that idea of just the usual form of a jazz tune, you know, where you have the set of changes, but you know, that set of changes, it represents a route, but there's all kinds of, maybe a better way to think of it is, it's more like you're looking at a field with some hills and some trees, and that there's all kinds of, you can go around the hill or over the hill or around the trees or up the trees, or you know, that there's all kinds of different ways of engaging with that kind of harmonic landscape.
Sure.
And so I think maybe that's part of just having worked with jazz in that way for so long, that's probably what gave me the, it felt like this was a viable approach. And but I think, you know, back to that, the question of form, you know, really, that's something I'm thinking through a lot now, about how to do this in a way that it doesn't sound like just a big, giant hour and a half long wind chime. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, I mean, like, yeah, if everything is basically just a chord, and you're just creating these melodies and that are consonant with that chord, well, that's certainly an approach, but an hour and a half of that could get a bit tiresome. And I think that, back to Lutosławski, that's one thing that I've been really compelled by with his work, is how he's able to kind of create these large and very, very clear structures that feel like they are going somewhere. And yet inside of that structure, there's play, there's freedom, there's flexibility. And, I've been, you know, digging into his work and his scores to sort of understand a bit better. I think he was kind of straining towards something like this idea of a hyperlink score. But, you know, he died before the internet came around.
That's fantastic, man. That's fantastic. And it's a fantastic record. Soma Schema is the latest record. Man, thanks so much for doing this. I want to have you back on. I think that there's a lot more to talk about that we can get into. There's a lot of fascinating ideas here that are really, really interesting to me.
Well, it was such a pleasure. Thanks so much
having me on. My pleasure. My pleasure. And we'll do it again for sure. Sounds great. All right. Sounds thanks, great. Joshua.
Thank you.
All right. That was my talk with double bassist and composer Joshua Stamper. If you are enjoying the Bass Shed podcast, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it. Leave a rating, leave a comment, tell your friends, do all the things. You can find the Bass Shed on Instagram at the_bass_shed. Facebook is still down. I haven't, you know, got that back off the ground. I got too many other things that are way more important to me than Facebook to deal with. But Instagram, I'm still there. Twitter, at Bass Shed on Twitter. And you can always stop by thebassshed.com and shoot me a note if you'd like to. All right. Joshua really, he dropped some heavy concepts there, I think. Man, when he was speaking about, you know, creating this kind of room and this environment and in like geometry terms, right? Like actually having a width and a depth and a height. And that's really, really fascinating to me. Because when I think about, you know, entering an atmosphere musically, it's just kind of a vibe, you know, it's a feeling. It's the feeling of an atmosphere. But really thinking about it in, you know, like some kind of floor plan or something, that's so next level. Absolutely, absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Highly recommend checking out his album. Again, I will have links to it at thebassshed.com/podcast/Joshua Stamper. Brilliant, brilliant composer. Brilliant composer. I can't say enough great things. Brilliant, brilliant work. That's all I got, folks. That's all I got for this one. Thanks for listening, and I will catch you on the next one in a minute.